60, which means nothing to you, I understand. But upon reviewing all the policies and procedures affecting the mental attitudes of citizens, it cannot well be denied that our government officials have embarked on a fatuous policy, which, in effect, is aiming to guide and constrain citizens as well as aliens in the exercise of liberties guaranteed to them by the First Amendment and the other provisions of the Bill of Rights. One convincing evidence of this intention is found in the endeavor, through procedures by the State Department and the Bureau of Immigration, to build a wall around the nation in the futile hope of preventing the spread in this country of foreign ideas or ideologies. For the implications and effect of regulations such as these go far beyond the exclusion of dangerous spies or saboteurs. The difficulties of administering this legal system in and of itself demonstrates how impossible it is to set precise standards or qualifications for individuals that set limits to the operation of these repressive policies. And whether or not the use of secret evidence and of information furnished by anonymous informants violates the due process clause in a technical, legalistic sense, there can be no doubt that these practices do violate the ancient historic traditions of fair play. When Festus, 2,000 years ago, reported to King Agrippa that his predecessor Felix had bequeathed to him a Roman prisoner named Paul, and that chief priests and elders desired to have judgment against him, he added, quote, "To them I answer, it is not the matter of the Romans to deliver any man to die. Before that, he, which is accused, have the accusers face to face, and have license to answer for himself concerning the crime laid against them." And this is the end of the quote. It's also from Scripture. It's Acts 25:16. And that was O'Brien using that quote. When the younger Pliny, as governor of Bithynia, requested the emperor Trajan to advise him as to the treatment of the new sect known as Christians, Trajan instructed him to let people alone unless they were found to be in violation of law. In that case, they were to be prosecuted like other offenders, but, added the emperor, anonymous accusations must not be admitted in evidence as against anyone, as it is introducing a dangerous precedent and out of accord with the spirit of our times. These historic statements throw into sharp relief some of the practices to which our government officials have recently been resorting. At the same time, they may help to restore something of our own traditional perspective and sanity of outlook. This is not the time or place to discuss in detail all the methods followed in administering the governmental policies or to catalog other peculiar features of the programs dealing with the national security. One pervasive fault is the failure of the department heads strictly to confine the operation of these programs to specific posts or specific areas, which in good faith can be denominated as sensitive. This fault, which goes very deep, may be due to indolence or indifference, but it is a fault which can and should be corrected. The soundness of this comment may be readily tested in any of the numerous cases of accusations made against persons working in the lower echelons of government or of private industry. Another important development showing how far we have departed from fundamental constitutional problems is the neglect of the presumption of innocence, which for so long has been the distinctive characteristic in the administration of justice among English-speaking peoples. Few persons seem to realize that in security cases, the accused person does not have the protection of the age-old presumption of innocence. On the contrary, he is confronted with accusations, and the burden is upon him to clear himself by refuting these accusations. Often, of course, in ignorance of secret evidence furnished by anonymous informers. In fact, if there is any presumption recognized in this field, it would seem to be a presumption of guilt. As I have said, the present executive order requires an affirmative finding that employment shall be clearly consistent with national security. And this qualification is generally interpreted to mean that every doubt must be resolved in favor of the government. The lack of comment upon this situation is in itself evidence of the insidious way in which plausible practices develop into dangerous tendencies. If this development becomes accepted law, does not experience indicate that it may be extended into other fields, undermining the importance of the presumption of innocence in all cases of accusation or prosecution? This particular question is one of the future to answer. The ancient right of privacy, so stoutly protected in common law, in which the Bill of Rights was intended to protect, you bet it was intended, but it didn't do it, receives little consideration. The common law right of protection against defamation has been greatly weakened, particularly by the use of anonymous accusations. Defamation, historically the most foul of all weapons used to impair integrity, has become a commonplace of reckless usage, both in governmental proceedings and in the comment of the general public. The anti-intellectual movements inspired by persons either ignorant or careless of our constitutional principles have become more widespread than ever before. Administrative officials without any special knowledge of constitutional philosophy all too often seem to regard the constitutional guarantees merely as rules of thumb which may be freely set aside in the interest of expediency. In contrast to this, the great American tradition was justified by the late Justice Jackson in these words. This is a quote. We can have an intellectual individualism and the rich cultural diversities that we owe to exceptional minds only at the price of occasional eccentricity and abnormal attitudes. When they are so harmless to others or to the state as those we deal with here, the price is not too great. But freedom to differ is not limited to things that do not matter much. That would be a mere shadow of freedom. The test of its substance is the right to differ as to things that touch the heart of the existing order. And that's the end of that quote, which was part of the case, Board of Education versus Barnett. All right, back to the text. The general indifference with which governmental agencies and public officials have disregarded fundamental rights of the citizen is, of course, illustrated in many other forms than those which I've mentioned. There is not space to discuss, for example, the work of some of the congressional committees, both in the House and in the Senate. Fortunately, the public at large now seem to realize the grievous wrong done to innocent persons by these committees, as well as the tyrannical and insolent behavior which has characterized some of their hearings. The exigencies of time and space have generally restricted our discussion to the operations of the federal government. But, as you well know, states and municipalities also have been promulgating their own security and loyalty regulations and conducting their own hearings, public and private. Indeed, it is in those multitudinous official activities that the American idea of fair play has been most seriously and perhaps more permanently damaged. It is in localities under the local government that some of the most obnoxious results of intolerance, censorship, and totalitarianism are taking place. Not the least of the dangers resulting from the policies concerning security has been the acquiescence of the general public and the lack of remonstrance on their part against the official programs, both statutory and executive, and their concomitant extra-constitutional practices. There are many reasons suggested for this phenomenon. The most potent derives from the acquiescence of the citizenry and the unprecedented growth of government regulatory power in the field of economics during the 1930s and World War II. In this area, the public mind became accustomed and habituated to numerous and drastic changes and limitations affecting property rights, which were the daily concern of every citizen. The average citizen, however, has little or no interest in the way in which loyalty and security programs affect other individuals. Unless he is personally involved, the problems seem remote to him. This, I think, provides one explanation of apparent indifference and lack of critical remonstrance towards governmental procedures which affect individual liberty. The extent to which the constant emphasis upon necessity for these programs has influenced public opinion was recently illustrated in an episode cited by Chief Justice Warren in his address at Washington University. And here's the quote. A few days ago, I read in the newspaper that a group of state employees charged with responsibility for determining what announcements could be posted on the employee's bulletin board refused to permit the Bill of Rights to be posted on the ground that it was a controversial document. It was reported that the altercation became intense, and that only after the governor in writing vouched for its non-controversial character was the Bill of Rights permitted to occupy a place along with routine items of interest to the state employees. And this happened in the United States of America on the 15th day of December, 1954, the 163rd anniversary of our Bill of Rights, declared by proclamation of President Eisenhower to be Bill of Rights Day. It is straws in the wind like this which cause some thoughtful people to ask the question whether ratification of the Bill of Rights could be obtained today, and we were faced squarely with the issue. That is the end of the quote. Back to the text. The significance of this incident cited by Chief Justice cannot be evaded. How far have the fundamental guarantees of the Bill of Rights been affected by these government programs? Is it true, as repeatedly asserted by some members of the Supreme Court, that we are witnessing a steady process of erosion of the most fundamental liberties of the citizen? Professor Stauffer's book contains much evidence that our traditional freedoms have undergone a marked decline in status in the eyes of the American public. For example, at the height of World War II, one quarter of the American public believed that it would be proper to suppress the publication of socialist newspapers. And here it states that you would distinguish socialist from communist. In 1953, however, that view was shared by almost half of the population. Similarly, in 1943, less than 33% of our people believed the restrictions upon freedom of speech. And in 1953, 45% of the public were in favor of limiting this basic right. Again, in 1943, only 30% of the American public were in favor of prohibiting all press criticism of our American form of government. But recent polls show that this group has risen to 42%. And you got to notice that it's because of times of war or any kind of what we went through in back of 9/11 that everybody's willing to cut everything down and just let what? The government or who have full reign to go wherever, do whatever in order to try to rout out the bad guys.
Arrested.
For what?
He's dangerous.
For libel. He's a spy.
Parker, that man's bad.
There's no law against that.
There is God's law.
And God can arrest him.
Why, you talk, he's gone.
And though he should, he was the devil himself until he broke the law.
So?
Now you give the devil benefit of the law.
Yes, what would you do? Cut a great road through the law to get after the devil?
Yes. I'd cut down every law in England to do that.
Oh? And when the last law was down and the devil turned round on you, where would you hide, Roper? The law's all being flat. This country is planted thick with laws from coast to coast. Man's laws, not God's. And if you cut them down, and you're just the man to do it, do you really think you could stand upright in the winds that would blow then? Yes. I give the devil benefit of law for my own safety's sake.
In 1955, moreover, the majority of the American people favored wiretapping of private telephones by the police. They approve of neighbors informing on neighbors to state authorities where unorthodox political beliefs are indicated. And who decides what's unorthodox? Yeah, who's the keeper of the rules and regulations about what's unorthodox? That's the bigger problem also, is that who gets charged with this weighty responsibility? Back to the text. And 50% of the American lawyers who were interviewed believed that the invocation of our historic privilege against self-incrimination is a clear indication of guilt. What do you have to hide? There's a footnote with this, and this is from Stauffer's writing in It's Communism, Conformity, and Civil Liberties. And on page 234 it is, all right? We get that straight. It's his book. And this is a quote from the book. Of the lawyers interviewed on the subject of the Fifth Amendment, 50% said they would be almost sure that a man really was a communist if he refused to tell the congressional committee whether he had ever been one. Also, 41% could offer no reason why a person would refuse to tell a committee he had never been a communist if he really never had been. Back to the text from the speech. This is indeed a disturbing picture for what worries our people most is their lack of confidence in the integrity of their fellow Americans and their fear that these people may become converted to the cause of communism. The statistics of the Stauffer survey clearly establish the general prevalence of this view, and certainly no development could be more satisfying to the Soviet leaders than the growth in this country of this poisonous element of mutual distrust. But isn't it clear to everybody, or at least it should be clear to you folks, that in order to save the Republic against people being converted to communism, you're actually moving more and more to statism as seen in communism. And this socialism is fine, but socialism is an entry into communism because the state becomes bigger and bigger and bigger. So in other words here, and I said this before, I guess, that in order to save whatever you call our form of government, we're going to go toward what people consider the antithesis of that form of government. Huh? Back to the text. There is one general feature common to all of these evils which up to now has received too little consideration. This is the human wastage among those who are made the victims of these inquisitions, both private and public. The damage to their morale and to those closely associated with them is intangible but very real. The anxiety, the sense of injustice, and in many cases the mental agony must inevitably leave permanent damage to say nothing of the resultant impairment of their initiative and inspiration. The social consequences of these contemporary evils is, of course, beyond computation. The doubt, the encouragement of curiosity, suspicion, and distrust, which have necessarily resulted from the nationwide inquiries made by FBI agents and representatives of our intelligence services, and from the atmosphere of secrecy which has crept into governmental affairs, have had far-reaching consequences. Another thing, taken all together, they have unquestionably had a definite effect in discouraging persons from joining any organization having any relation to public affairs. Worse than that, they have brought down intolerant attacks upon character-building agencies throughout the country and even upon certain types of religious activity. One curious paradox growing out of this program of government activity is that instead of promoting a sense of security among the citizenry, it has had the opposite effect of spreading doubt, suspicion, and mistrust, and creating, particularly for those in government employ, a real and anxious sense of insecurity. All this discussion may be epitomized in the question, do these governmental procedures dissipate suspicion or encourage the growth of freedom? The answer must be emphatically no, and the question really embodies the acid test for, as John Dewey put it, and there's a quote from Dewey, anything that obscures the fundamentally moral nature of the social problem is harmful, no matter whether it proceeds from the side of physical or of psychological theory. Any doctrine that eliminates or even obscures the function of choice, of values, and enlistment of desires and emotions in behalf of those chosen weakens personal responsibility for judgment and for action. It thus helps create the attitudes that welcome and support the totalitarian state. That's from Dewey's Freedom and Culture, 1939. And I have to laugh because Dewey really was one of the major proponents of collectivism, that the individual's worth is gauged by what he or she can do for the republic, for the state. So this is Rich coming out of his mouth, and this is the guy that they entrusted the education system to, along with the other behavioral modificators from University of Chicago, like Benjamin Bloom and good old Skinner. Back to the text. As I have already reiterated, the basic problem is how to maintain a balance between the need for security against the communist threat and the preservation of the ancient liberties guaranteed by the Bill of Rights. No one can deny or underrate the difficulties presented by this undertaking, but these difficulties should not prevent an attempt to find a fair and sane solution. To find an answer for this question, an appraisal must also be made of the intangible forces that have given the American polity its astonishing stability and resilience. Professor Whitehead believed that no race in the history of mankind has ever shown such innate and pervasive qualities of cooperation and tolerance, and that the American social system is on the whole the best that has ever existed. It is also well to bear in mind that for the average citizen, the guarantees of the Bill of Rights are definitely moral principles. For him, they mean the difference between right and wrong. The Constitution and the Bill of Rights do have a definite ethical content. Taken together, these qualities of conviction and applied conscience have produced that extraordinary and distinctive characteristic of the Americans, their sense of fair play. This is all well and good, that we have the best system. But the problem now is whether you want to argue whether it was the best system or not, and I would say it certainly was one of the best, if not the best, and that is it's being eroded. And they're leading the people to do such. And that's why, you know, Trotsky's guard of terrorism and communism is so important. And that is, if the government, the state, can induce its people to give up the liberties for the promise, and you've heard this 1,000 times, right, for security, which they cannot guarantee, well, you know, you're finished. Because it starts off seemingly innocent, and may in fact be, but by the time it winds up, it's already too far down the road. The citizen has his own time-honored standards of fair play, which determine for him what constitutes a fair trial or a fair hearing. Under this concept, as Mr. Justice Jackson pointed out, a hearing of any description given to an individual involving his liberty, property, or good name cannot be a fair hearing unless the person involved is fully apprised of the evidence against him and is given the opportunity to cross-examine the witnesses whose evidence is used against him. whether or not in a legalistic and technical sense the security hearings fall within the protection of the Due Process Clause, they certainly violate the fundamental American sense of fair play. And here's a quote from, it's contained in Essentials of Democracy, page 48, and it's in the case of Nugent versus U.S., 346 U.S. 1. And here's the footnote. Strangely enough, this truth is given recognition in the regulations applicable only to conscientious objectors in the enforcement of the Selective Service Act. These regulations require that the applicant be furnished a fair resume of the derogatory information contained in the secret files. Okay. All right, we move on. Illustrations will readily occur, countless in number, on the test of fair play, which instinctively affects every phase of conduct, private and public, in our nation. This is not to say that the American people in the mass are invariably right in their judgments. The real fact is that when they are fully informed, they are usually right. Now, Rousseau, Lord Lindsay says, is often supposed to have said that the general will is always right. He did not. He said it was always honest. What he was insisting on was the power of the ordinary man to judge of fair play, of honesty, of conformance with the spirit of the community. It is essential to note another of the all-important elements working for sanity in the American society. In no other nation known to history has community cooperation been so fully developed. As has been said on other occasions, the fact that there are in this country more than 1,800 community chests annually activated by hundreds of thousands of citizens, to say nothing of the seemingly endless separate community efforts in behalf of the Red Cross, hospital, schools, etc., is of outstanding significance. But none of you remember the community chest, do you? Yeah, that's how great that was. That thing was dead, I'm seriously, in the early 60s, as far as I know. I mean, I lived in a couple of towns, and I never saw any community chest out there. Back to the text. This is not alone because of the effect of these cooperative movements in developing common understanding, but because they do not exist and cannot be maintained in any other country. The unifying power exerted by these activities produces a stabilizing power beyond all measurement. Words such as religion, conscience, and morality are avoided by political scientists, yet they represent determinative factors in the American civilization, and in every crisis have been powerful factors in directing the course of public opinion. I would question that. In short, there is just below the surface of our national life a vast web of interlocking forces of cooperation animated by the voluntary activities of free citizens. No appraisal of ideas, philosophical, political, or social, can be made without taking into account all these forces constantly promoting the principles of common morality and fairness. Added to the existence of this fundamental moral tradition is, of course, the tremendous influence of public education in sharpening the perceptions and, generally speaking, developing the intelligence of the people. Incidentally, how far men may go astray when they are without adequate information or when they act only on emotional impulse is shown by Professor Stauffer's discouraging statement that 50% of the American lawyers interviewed believe that the invocation of our historical privilege against self-incrimination is a clear indication of guilt. Leave it to the lawyers. All right, nevertheless, Professor Stauffer hazards the informed guess that as the internal threat of communism declines, so will intolerance of the unorthodox decline. Many of us believe that this is a correct view, but even if it is wrong, or if the menace of domestic communism does not subside, we believe that the great imponderable forces which in the long run determine the character of public opinion will bring back respect for individual freedom. Despite the discouragement of the present time and the recognition, for the time being at least, of alien procedures and policies in conflict with our traditional freedoms, we must never forget that the constitutional guarantees of personal immunities, as Judge Cardozo wrote and reiterated, are, quote, so rooted in the tradition and conscience of our people as to be ranked as fundamental, end of quote. But you can believe that all that has been eroded. You want to talk to any student in school today? In the public school system, ask them about this and see what they have to say. They are definitely, they have been manipulated through the education system and, of course, media with all its garbage and supposed objective news shows and articles and such, that they are little widgets that absorb stuff and do not ask questions. If you yell loud enough to them, they figure you're right. And it's not their fault necessarily, because that's the way they've been indoctrinated, and this has been going on since I got out. I mean, I wasn't crazy about the public education system, but what it's turned into is certainly a conditioner of thought and not of critical analysis. And that's from teachers who've also gone down through the same thing. I mean, it's amazing. Several discoveries of the Stafford survey make particularly for optimism. One is the finding that the country over, the better-educated citizens are more tolerant than the less well-educated. I'm sorry, that's just not the case anymore. People think they're educated because they've taken a lot of information. And they figure the more information they take in, if it's more than what the other guy has taken in, that they're better suited, more informed. Nobody ever questions about the purity of the information, which is going through mainstream media, completely and utterly poisoned. Equally important is his finding that the leaders in the local communities are more tolerant than the rank and file. This is especially significant because these leaders who were interviewed comprised not only public officials, but commanders of the American Legion and officials of all kinds of local organizations. Although there are always present latent forces of political bigotry and intolerance, there are also present powerful and assertive elements of moral leadership. But the reaction will not come until disinterested leaders of public opinions and presumably educators assume the unpopular burden of resenting the current encroachments upon civil liberty and, more important, provide constructive suggestions for such changes in administrative policy as will restore the confidence and independence of the individual and strengthen once again his faith in the liberties guaranteed him by the Constitution. You go out there and you do this. You do your little survey on these attitudes. Man, they are Eloy. I have told you the discouraging history of the evolution of a new and un-American legal philosophy implemented by what I believe is to be unjustified encroachments on the fundamental guarantees of liberty to the citizen. But I would not leave you with a note of pessimism. Oh, no, not that. Serious as these evils are, they were, after all, born in an era of blind emotionalism and in an atmosphere of unreasoning fear akin to panic. Sound familiar? Like 17 years ago? The great misfortune is that the issues of loyalty and security have been seized upon by unscrupulous politicians and used as political weapons by selfish partisans. The power and devastating effect of this malign influence is evidenced by the relative scarcity of leaders courageous and outspoken in the cause of individual freedom. When they appear, we are confident that the sense of fair play will assert its power among our people. These practices have been originated and put into effect by men in authority who seemingly lack understanding of the great American constitutional and moral tradition. Some of us are nevertheless optimists. We trust the integrity and the beliefs of the common man, that strange, indefinable being on the surface, ridiculous in the depths profound. And that's a quote from William Dixon from The Human Situation, 1938. Perhaps we've been at fault in assuming that democracy is a dogma and in thinking of it as exempt from the ordinary laws that govern human nature, whereas democracy is not a dogma but a faith and a reasoned faith. To exemplify the transcendent quality of law and to live by the ultimate authority of ethical principle is an austere and difficult achievement. It is said of the late F.S. Oliver that, quote, he took the liveliest interest in the problem of government, which he approached not as a matter of theory, but as an endless adventure of the impact of character upon circumstances, end of quote. The distinctive contribution of the Americans to the success of that, quote, endless adventure, unquote, has been their realization of the necessity for self-restraint, for self-discipline, and for faith in the power of ideas. If anybody had any more, It is true, as I have said, that in a democracy there is always latent the cancer of indifference and apathy. Over against us, however, is the fact that the Americans in their personal and social relationships, as well as in their response to the demands of patriotism and to the needs of common humanity, have exemplified the finest qualities in their sense of civic and neighborhood obligations. One explanation for their occasional indifference to the operations of government is that the complicity of government organization and its multiform functions baffle and bewilder the average citizen, and they're made to do that. He rarely understands the true significance of the many policies practiced, particularly by the central government. But what is significant above all other developments is that wherever political or social issues are clarified and take on the aspect of a moral issue, the American public react promptly and powerfully. This is a truth that escapes notice of many foreign observers. If our people could but understand this imaginative approach, more consideration would be given to the intangibles, quote, the constant things, end of quote, that give permanence and power to the democratic faith. The most serious aspect of the present-day trends threatening our democratic traditions is that our people have been confused as to the real issues involved, nor have they any way to determine the real extent of internal dangers. Sadder than all else, there is a dearth of leaders capable of emphasizing the moral issues which are involved. The Court Reorganization Bill of 1937 was defeated because of the moral resentment expressed by the great mass of people whose sense of fair play was outraged by the proposal. The same uprising of the public conscience has lately destroyed the power of evil political adventurers. An even more striking instance of this same truth was the enthusiasm which recently greeted the decision of the Supreme Court condemning President Truman's seizure of the steel plants. Many other instances of this same quality are constantly coming to the surface in our local communities. The sense of right and wrong, or, if you will, of conscience, demonstrates the existence and the power of the moral tradition, which, in America at least, overshadows in the last analysis the realm of law and of politics. At present, that sense of conscience is obscured, but surely in time a sense of fair play will assert itself as it has in the past. Faith in the honesty and integrity of the average citizen continues to be the cornerstone of the American state. The aberrations from our tradition of justice, which we have been scrutinizing, need not be permanent. The chief responsibility for these rests upon those high in official authority in the nation. If and when our leaders in the executive, congressional, and judicial departments awaken to their obligation to protect the freedom of the human spirit, they will, like their great predecessors, respond to that obligation. The public, with the issues clarified, will then also respond to the sense of moral responsibility, and out of the present confusion will come a rededication to the cause of freedom in our time. In this confident belief must be our hope. Well, I tell you what, that ain't happening, as we have seen. And it's not because I want it to be that way, but I'm tired of, after 7 decades of watching things, say that anything else except a deterioration of the American way of life, the American economic situation, is getting any better, is meant to get any better. That whenever trouble starts, all you have to do is threaten Americans with, well, you know, terror and all this other stuff, and they'll do whatever you want them to do. Do what you want, they say, just to keep us safe. Well, they're going to do what they want, but it's not going to keep us safe. And unfortunately, the hope that O'Brien had has not come to fruition. And it's not going to come to fruition, because we are in our way, in our own little solution, I should say formula, if you will, that is concocted to take America down, and it's being taken down, and it's death by a thousand cuts. And it's been going on for quite some time, but never as much as it has since 9/11. I mean, how many times do you have to see the news media pop a microphone in some bubblehead's face and say, well, how do you feel about, you know, having to give up your freedoms for the security? I'll do whatever you have to do. I mean, really? They never went to somebody else and asked them what they thought? No. This is a complete conditioning. And it's pervasive. I mean, ever since entertainment and news and all that other stuff, 24-7, Bretton circuses and the sands of the Coliseum. Keep the peasants happy so they don't have to think that they are willingly not. Just give me my iPhone and forget about whatever the reality is around you because I like this world better. Okay, well, good luck with that. There ends the series on national security and individual freedom by John Lord O'Brien. You know, it's the way of speakers and writers to believe you with something, but if we do this, we're going to be okay. We're going to return to a world that never existed, by the way. So, you know, I'm sorry, but I'm here to tell you that ain't going to happen. You know, this is bad news central, you got it. But I think you people ought to be able to see for yourself that there isn't going to be any antidote by government. There's going to be no help from them. They are in on it, folks. And they've been in on it for arguably a century. Now, O'Brien was a statesman. He actually cared. He didn't care what branch of government was in office. He didn't want to see certain tendencies continue. And they did. And here we are. So you've got to figure out what you're going to place your faith in. But I would say it's misplaced if you think government, any elected official, any party will bring about the brotherhood of man and the great eon to come. It isn't going to happen. So strap yourself in, because it's going to be a long and strange, dangerous and fatal journey. And until next time, we hope you'll join us again. Good night.
Sure.